This is Kenai Garden Talk on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. I'm Jenny Nyman. It continues to be a slow, cold, soggy start to spring this May, but the gardening scene is heating up. The Central Peninsula Garden Club is holding workshops every Saturday this month, giving gardeners a chance to pick the brains of experts on a variety of topics. Last week, KDLL tagged along for some sweet insight into growing berries at Alaska Berries Farm and gathered snippets of information on tree pruning. But first, the Cooperative Extension Service recently finished up a series of weekly community classes with information on how to make your garden inhospitable to pests. The key? Don't invite them in the first place. Janice Chumley is the Integrated Pest Management Technician for the University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service in Soldotna. That means teaching people to manage and mitigate pests. And that begins with good garden planning before you ever start your planting.
So in this talk, I'm going to talk about something that I think is really cool, and it's how to plant your garden so that you can reduce the pest pressure that you're going to receive. Because let's be honest, there is no such thing as a pest-free garden. You know, look at the magazine picture and, you know, enjoy it, because it is not reality. All years have pests, and those pests can be aphids falling off your tree. They can be your neighbor's dog coming in and, you know, rolling around and stuff. There's many forms of pests, and so this is just ideas about how to reduce the pest pressure through actions that you can do. The first thing that I would like you to understand is that you need to know what the pests are. If it's your neighbor's dog, it's pretty obvious. But if it's bugs, you need to have some good identification resources, and everybody should consider investing $1.98 in one of these, because a hand lens will serve you a lot of good, and I go around with it in my back pocket when I'm out and about. So the first thing you think about is, what do I need to keep things out of my garden area? And really, it's a fence. When you consider pests, one of our largest pests is moose. And even if they have not visited your garden in 20 years, sooner or later they're going to, and they're going to put it on their internal GPS, and they're going to come back year after year, and they're going to teach their offspring to come back. So having a fence to keep them out just makes sense. I have raised beds. I don't have a big garden area. I live in Nikiski. I have moose that camp out in my yard. We have created little hoops with rubberized chicken wire that goes over it, so air goes through, rain goes through, sunlight, everything else, but the moose can't get there. It's on hinges, so I can simply pick it up, and with a counterweight it stays open. I can work in there. I can do whatever I need. So fencing is pretty important to keep out the big thing. And in addition to the big animals, we do have a lot of small animals that really will do a lot of damage in your garden. Those things are usually voles, mice. Shrews not so much. You know, I know that we like to lump them all together as rodents, but shrews are insectivores. They eat other bugs. They eat slugs. So if you had shrews in your garden, you'd be going, go shrews. You wouldn't try to trap them out. But with other things, like with the voles or with mice, which are becoming a little bit more common, you really don't want to have them stay in your garden, because, first of all, they poop where they eat, and they pee where they eat, which is kind of disgusting. And they, for things like your root crops, which we all grow a lot of, carrots, parsnips, potatoes, they eat them. They'll take a few bites of this one and a few bites of that one, and they won't just eat one whole thing. And then they like to squirrel it away for the winter. So, you know, you'll have bites of many things, and they'll make these little midden piles where they store food for later on. So keeping the population on small animals down is really good. So how do we think about doing that? I'm a fan of sticky traps. These are just monitoring tools that you can use to see how many critters are in your garden. If you know that you have voles in your yard, use snap traps. You can bury coffee cans, put something over them that is attractive to them, like a wire with some peanut butter on it. They'll jump on that, fall in, and drown. They travel on pheromone trails, so they like to be close to walls or some kind of barrier. Everything in the world wants to eat a bull. So they run on the same areas all the time. They like to be in tall grass. You're going to want to mow the grass down around your garden area, even if you don't have grass, if it's just our native plant mix, if you will. Keep it mowed. They don't like to travel out because a lot of things from above attack them. You can regulate their population by hanging out some, or putting out some sticky traps. They'll be caught in this. Do with it what you will, throw them away. With squirrels, you can use a live trap. Fish and Game will loan you live traps on a first come, first serve basis. And I find squirrels to be a problem in the garden because of strawberries. For whatever reason, they like strawberries, but so do I. And I prefer that it was me that harvested the strawberries instead of the squirrels. Mm-hmm. Just saying. The other thing to consider too, and this is for pest production, is crop rotation. A lot of times we think, well, this is my potato bed. This is always my potato bed because potatoes supposedly don't like lime in the soil or what have you. But rotating crops is a huge way to reduce pests, disease, you know, constant problems with the soil and mostly with plant disease. You know, if you have something, if you have the same thing growing in the soil year after year, it becomes more vulnerable to diseases pretty much. So, you know, or fungi like downy mildew, powdery mildew, botrytis, things like that. So rotating your crops, it will help out to reduce pest pressures. The other thing that folks don't consider a lot is plant spacing. We all get these little plants. We either grow them from seeds ourselves or we go into the greenhouses. And you plant four of them and you think, oh, that looks good, but I got these other two and I'm just putting them in there. You water them and fertilize them and they grow and they're big and suddenly they're crowded. There's no elbow room. Air can't get through them. Bugs can hide underneath the leaf foliage and stuff. And if you would have just stopped at those four plants, it would have been better instead of planting all six of them. So plant spacing is a big deal. Now we're going to get into the bug part. And you have transplants that you're going to plant. Oh, you have broccoli starts or cabbage starts or things like that. And you know that in your area you have cutworms. It's the larval stage of a noctuid moth. Noctuid, fancy word for night flying. So they're moths, you know, big deal. You see them everywhere. It's a big deal when they're in your garden. And you come out in the morning and all your little transplants are falling over, and because they've chewed them off, you dig in the soil and you see this caterpillar that turns into a C when you mess with it. And that's a cutworm. So how do you think about, well, I know that I've had problems with them last year. I saw a lot of moths. What am I going to do? So these are everywhere. People have tons of pots. You simply cut the bottom out of it, and I dig this down into the soil and I bury it about this deep. This is below the soil, this is above the soil. The things below the soil will stop the cutworms from accessing the plants and chewing them off. In addition to working for cutworm control with this, at the very top, you put your transplant in here. It gives a little bit of a windbreak. And if you're really planning ahead, you can outwit the root maggots that are going to want to eat your broccoli or cabbage or cauliflower at the same time that you can outwit the cutworms by pushing this into the soil and taking some simple sand. You can use grit, you can use sand or whatever. Place it all around the transplant. Root maggots like to lay eggs near a food source for their offspring. Those eggs hatch. They wiggle down into the soil, start feeding on the roots. That's the actual maggot of the fly. But if you have sand over that area, or if you have some people use dryer lint. People can use wood ash. You can use diatomaceous earth, but I will say that that becomes fairly expensive because they lose their sharp edges after a little while, so you'll have to replace that frequently. Sand, to me, is a very effective way of reducing, of making this less attractive. Now we're going to get into the other thing that I find is problematic in gardens, and that's slugs. Last year, it was wet, it was cool, people got sick of going out and picking them, and they laid eggs with great abandonment. And now, this spring, you're going to find those egg clusters, and as soon as it warms up enough, they'll actually hatch out in this little tiny slug. And you won't see them until they're bigger when they've been eating your stuff all this time. So slugs are very difficult to control in that we all want to just wave a magic wand and have them go away, and there isn't one. You know, there truly isn't one. It takes a lot of pre-planning to reduce the slug populations. One of those is to handpick, look early, keep the vegetation down around your garden bed. If you have a raised garden bed, using copper L-shape on the top so that they would have to crawl over that to get into there. I have gravel around the outside of it because I'd like to reduce the environment to have slugs coming into it. But once slugs have gotten in here, like they did last year, I'm going to be plagued because they're in the garden. So I don't want to use those great baits that you can use to say, oh, come on in, I got plenty of food, because I'm trying not to attract more slugs into the area. So ideally, what I'm going to have to be doing, and really soon, is to go out there and start squishing. And it's disgusting, I admit it. But, you know, if you have things like a board that you can put out now and flip it over on a daily basis and dispose of them, the slugs that are underneath it. If you had chickens and, you know, you wanted to let them run through an area and pick at all the eggs and stuff, you will reduce the numbers of slugs somewhat. But that only works if you haven't planted yet, because chickens don't care. They'll eat everything. There are products that you can use. One of them, I'm sure everybody here is familiar with Sluggo, but it's in a meal base, and research shows that only 40% of the juvenile slugs are attracted to Sluggo. So the other 60% are just going off and ignoring it. So having a slug party, you know, say, why couldn't we all get together once a week and go to different people's houses, you know? Spend an hour trashing slugs. Next week you come to my house, you know, we'll spend it here. You know, you might consider that in your neighborhood, having just a little death and destruction party, if you will. So, with slugs, you realize that when you are planting, you're going to want to ensure that you remove the lower vegetation, remove the leaves. Most plants don't need all those bottom leaves anyways. They can act as ladders for pests. Keep them trimmed up. Keep the area. Coarse sand around plants really does help. You know, slugs, they don't have a skeleton, so they travel on slime trails. So you want to interrupt that. And copper is one of the things that interrupts it by giving them an electrical shock, or some people have gone as far as using ground glass, which seems kind of extreme to me, but diatomaceous earth, coarse sand, you know, keeping vegetation down, hand picking is really beneficial. And in a raised bed area, you want to bait them outside. You don't want to invite them to come in. You want to make them leave that raised bed and go outside. So Rory McDonald, who is a world-renowned malacologist, who now works for UC Davis, he did a number of studies and found out that actually cucumbers work really best. Cucumbers are more attractive to slugs than anything. So if you are trying to attract a slug away from your garden bed, you could put cucumber slices in, oh, any kind of like a plant saucer or whatever that has salt water in there, say. But they'll crawl in to get to that cucumber slice and the salt water will kill them. When you're thinking about moving slugs outside of your garden area, instead of having them inside your garden area, you can buy slug traps. You can make your own. here's a water bottle, you can use soda bottles, you can use anything like that. Cut it off, turn it inside like this, connect it, pour whatever substance you like in there, even cucumber water perhaps, and then lay it on its side. The liquid does not escape due to the seal here. The slug smells, because they have a good sense of smell. They're attracted into it, they slime their way up into here. They drop down, they can't get out. You don't want to put salt onto the soil because obviously salt is not good for plant growth, but you can certainly pick them up and throw them in there.
How about water with a little ammonia?
You can do that as well, but people think that they can spray it on the ground and it's just going to stop slugs from coming into an area, and it will not. It has to come in contact with the slug's body. And so you can use water and ammonia, like you could do that and bait them in with cucumbers or whatever, but if you're going to actually use the ammonia water, you have to spray it on the slug itself. It's not a deterrent. There is nothing that stops slugs from coming into an area. But it is very effective, and it doesn't hurt the soil the way that salt does. Man, I like slugs. They're so interesting. So if you have more questions and you enjoyed this great activity, call the Cooperative Extension Service. We're located right down the road, 262-5824. You know, give us a shout out. My job is to help you to be more successful in your gardening endeavors. And I really like my job. So give me a call. It's what I get paid to do, and it's fun for hopefully everybody.
Thanks to Janice Chumley. You can find much more information from the Cooperative Extension Service at uaf.edu/CES. When we come back, there's no more literal fruit for your labor in Alaska gardening than berries. Brian Olson with Alaska Berries will tell us how to maximize that fruit.
Hi, I'm Sabrina.
And this is Vivian.
And we're the staff of Northern Lights Therapeutic Tape Advantage in Kenai at 610 Atla Way, Suite Number 4, 907-690-2010. We will be donating 30% of our proceeds from now until June 30th. And we would like to encourage other businesses to participate with us in a challenge to help raise money for KDLL programming. We are asking that businesses donate a percentage of their proceeds up until June 30th. And the public can come by the businesses and purchase goods and services for KDLL programming.
KDLL has until June 30th to meet our federal match requirement. Thanks to Northern Lights Therapeutic Tape Advantage for helping us get there. If your business would like to participate, give us a call at 283-8433. Welcome back. This is Kenai Garden Talk on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman. Brian and Lori Olson of Alaska Berries gave a workshop for the Central Peninsula Garden Club last week. Alaska Berries makes and sells wine, syrup, and jam at the end of West Poppy Lane off Kalifornsky Beach Road. They grow all their own fruit, several varieties of raspberries, blueberries, saskatoons, red and black currants, strawberries, gooseberries, rhubarb, and their pioneer plant, the Hascap.
And none of this is bragging or arrogance, but it's just fact. These don't exist anywhere else. We started our Hascap program by getting actual plant material from Japan. We've been breeding here to develop strains that work here for us, that we have trialed thousands of them. And the ones that we have left now are the proven varieties that work well for us. These are an incredible plant, three times the antioxidants of a blueberry, loaded with anthocyanins, vitamins. It will be very common in the U.S. here in another 5 years, I think, as being the new superberry. And it's very easy to grow. It'll suffer through a wide range of pHs and weather conditions. They live 40 to 60 years is the projected lifespan of one. By the time they get to be 8 years old, they yield about 25 to 30 pounds per plant. And it's our number one crop on the farm. What I consider one of the most important things is your soil. When I say Haskeps can tolerate a wide range, you could go out and dig a hole in your backyard and stick it there, and the plant will live, but it's going to be at the bottom of production. When you put more time and money into your soil, you're going to have a better chance at having a prime crop, a prime healthy plant. So a lot of folks, you know, because of time, money, and resources or whatever, they neglect the soil. And no matter where you buy your plant, if you neglect your soil or not sure about, you know, what it needs, get a soil sample. The Co-op Extension Agency has a little pamphlet, and there's a lab out of Ohio, $35. You get a soil sample. Dr. Casey Downer is a PhD in soil science. He'll interpret your results. He'll tell you exactly what you got to do to mend your soil. If you get your soil right, plant your plants, you know, you have a lot better chance of success. Because our soil is young soil here. It'll support a boreal forest just fine. But when you're trying to grow something that's not, you have to do things to it.
How long does it take your Haskeps to start producing?
Year two, you'll get berries. I consider them, by the time they're 3 years old, you should get a good hand, you know, something like that. But it just goes up each year. Like I said, by the time they're 7 or 8 years, you're going to be getting 20, 25 pounds. If you have a good year, soil's good, Mother Nature's cooperative, or we're cooperative with her, whatever you want to say it. This is all bird netting, all the way around, sides, top, all gets buttoned in. If you're going to grow berries, you got to put bird netting over them. If you have berry plants and you haven't had any birds, you will. I was told that by a professional, but being a stubborn Norwegian, I didn't do any bird netting, but the plants were tiny back then. And the Saskatoons, we'll walk down here, they were loaded with berries, but they were just little guys, and I kept tasting them because they turned blue real early on. But they're just about as bland as eating cardboard. But if you wait, and about 4 weeks after they first turn blue, a long time after they turn blue, and that's the problem with Saskatoons. A lot of folks see them turn blue and eat them and say, "Mother, there's nothing there." And there isn't, but they get sweeter. And the birds know that, and they'll come and they'll test just like a human. And they won't eat them until they get to the peak of Brix content. The sweetest they'll ever get. I came out here and told my wife, I said, we're getting the pickers tomorrow. These berries are loaded with them. Of course, they didn't look like this then. They were just little guys. Came out at 7 o'clock next morning. There wasn't a berry on these bushes.
Oh, my gosh.
It was poop from here down to there with seeds in it. Oh. Them berries, they came in that night, and it just, and it was like that Alfred Hitchcock.
Right.
The birds took off, and that was it. I said, I'm done. We're going to put bird netting up and not fool around. So bird netting, if you're going to be doing, even if you're doing a couple of individual plants, they're going to be bottom when they're green, but when they start turning blue, the bird's going to go for them. So if you want berries, at least the Haskeps, Saskatoons, blueberries, we don't bird net the raspberries. So these Saskatoons are three varieties, Northline, Smoky, and Pembina. They came from Saskatchewan. They work really well for us. From Ornamental Beauty, they just have beautiful white flowers on them. If you come back in about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, drive down the road, this will be just beautiful white, like cherry blossoms in there. So if you're looking for a landscape plant, these plants live a long time, 40, 50 years, they say. They'll get 12 to 20 feet tall if you let them, but we keep ours pruned below the bird netting. It varies from season to season with these things. 1 year you get a pretty good crop, next year it's a little late. They're kind of like cherry trees. If you notice the cherry trees, you get a big crop 1 year, next year it's not quite so good. I don't know quite what the deal is with that, but we have enough of them that when we do get a good crop of them, I think we got 1,200 pounds 1 year. This little section is the blueberries, and this is probably the most difficult plant to grow, in my opinion. Up here, even though you can walk right out here in the woods and pick wild blueberries to as long as you like. These are domesticated cultivars. This is North Blue. North Sky and North Country are the three that we have found to be the best blueberries to grow here. They are the finickest plant to grow, bar none. But when you get a good crop, they're the size of a quarter and they're sweet, they're juicy. We just finished putting top dressing on this, and I've got this recipe on the website, so you don't have to take notes on it. If you want to grow blueberries, you can't dig a hole and stick a blueberry in the ground here. It'll grow for a few years and it'll just die. You have to have 4.5 to 5 pH. And the only way you're going to get that is either be in a peat bog and you've tested it, or mix it up with what we use is bark, shredded bark, peat that's like 4.2 pH, a little bit of perlite, and bone meal. Bone meal is like 1300, so it's got a lot of nitrogen in there. And anytime you add a bark or wood product to your soil, it's going to start robbing some nitrogen away from the soil, so you have to add some back. Gooseberries. Inimaki red gooseberries, my favorite. We still got to get in here and do a little bit more pruning. They're just starting to break bud right now. These are from Finland, and we really like these guys. They turn red when they're ripe. They have a sweet, tangy, sour taste all at once. Make a phenomenal syrup, jam. The gooseberry wine is one of those wines where you either love it or you hate it. So it's fun to watch folks come in the tasting room, and the wife will take a drink and just say, that's the best wine I ever had, and the husband will take a drink, and I'll pass on that one. They're thorny, which is, they don't need to be bird netted. These are black currants.
Black currants.
Yeah, these are Titanias. A lot of varieties of black currants will grow up here very well. I like these because they get taller and they get loaded with big, pretty good sized black currants, and makes a phenomenal wine. We win gold medals with our wine with this plant. It's got a really rich, earthy, that's how you can tell a black currant is just, it's got an odor like nothing else. Mm-hmm. Some people call it cat pee. Isn't that right? No, I'm serious. That's a term, cat pee.
The
first time somebody said about my wine, I thought they were insulting me until I looked it up in the manual, and that's an actual description for one of the things for wine, and it doesn't necessarily mean negative things. Anyway, black currant. These are red currants. We've trialed quite a few different varieties throughout the years, and we'd plant them and didn't like them, we'd rip them up, compost them, plant new ones. These are our Holland Long Bunch. We started these years ago. We purchased some propagation stock from a nursery up in Talkeetna. She had been growing them for quite a few years, and we thought they were a pretty good plant, and we're really happy with them. Hardy, grow, come back every year, not too picky. Aphids, love them, so you got to stay on them for aphids. Other than that, they're pretty much the same kind of soil requirements as 6.5 to 7 pH. They'll grow in partial shade. They do like full sun. There's a different pruning cycle for these. It's on my website too, but black currants bear fruit on their first and second year wood. And that's it. That's second year wood you see here, and that's still gonna go clear up to that wire. And then we prune those stems off year 3. Some folks with black currants, if you grow 2 rows, they'll alternate. They'll just go in and save time pruning. They'll just mow one row right to the ground and let that come back, because next year you'll have some berries, the second year you'll have some berries, and the third year you cut out that third year cane. Red and white currants are a little bit different. What we recommend is you wait till year 4 and then you prune out the oldest wood, and you only have 4 to 5 branches of each successive year, because they bear fruit on their spurs on their first, second, third year wood. And when you prune, do it when they're dormant, either in the fall, which isn't really convenient. Either season you can do it if they're dormant. And there's some years you can get out in the fall when they're completely asleep, and some years you can't because of the weather. So you wait till that spring, and then you have to get out there in the spring regardless when you have the time to get them pruned. I don't leave the clippings in the field. Chop them up, compost them if you want, or take them out of the field. Rhubarb. This last year, I think we picked 1,200 pounds of rhubarb, chopped. And this year, we're hoping to get about 1,500 or 1,600 pounds for our wines.
What do you do when they come up with a flower?
We pull the seed stalks.
Just pull the flower stalk out? You don't do anything else?
Just pull it out.
Okay. That's
reach down, do twist, pull, chop. That's we just throw them right down the middle of the row. Okay. And let everything rot, and we go down through here with the riding lawnmower, and it's just all vegetation goes back in. We don't let anything go to seed. Mm-hmm. Other than that, they say every 7 years you should split your rhubarb.
Okay.
Core it off when you start seeing it get hollow in the middle. It's a wonderful plant to grow. It's easy, low maintenance. The slugs do love to live under them. We save every eggshell that we use, and we crush them up, and we put eggshells around everything. Yeah, the ducks and geese eat it too, but they help for slug control. Slugs crawl across there and does them some damage. These two rows were strawberry fields from last year. We are done growing strawberries outside. We did that for years, and again, it's a gamble. We had 5,000 or 7,000 plants up in that quarter acre field many years ago, and they were just beautiful strawberry. And about a pound of plant was our guess. That's like 5,000 pounds of strawberries. And that was a wasp year, and the wasp came in, and it was so bad we couldn't even pick any of them. And we lost that whole crop. So when you do outside strawberries, it works. You can do it. It's a lot of work. You got to be on them. We use wedding veil to cover them to keep the wasp off now. If you start a strawberry bed and you have to determine what's your goal, is it going to be for production or reproduction? Then you buy a bare root plant and you plant it, and it grows, it's going to send out what I call the daughter plants, and any place they can touch to the ground, they're going to root up. See how these are all tasked with that runner? And then you can take these daughter plants and transplant them where you want them and propagate your own plants. But if you're looking for yield, you want to pull every runner and not let it daughter plant out, and you get a bigger yield.
And then how long will that original plant be good for you?
I would pull this plant next year. It'll be year three. Oh. Pull it out of the field.
Oh, really?
But, yeah, strawberries. So, you know, you have to determine it. If you want to just start with a few plants and let the daughter plants go out and start your own strawberry patch, you still want to move them because you'd like to have about a foot between every plant. Don't want to overcrowd them strawberries. Yeah.
What varieties of raspberries are you growing?
We're growing over here. Our number one raspberry is the Latham. It's a zone 4, so it's real risky. We say we get crop 7 out of 10 years. We don't get a crop every year because of some problem, because it's not a zone 3. A Boyne raspberry is a zone 3, and we grow one row of Boynes because they are winter hardy. You can't hardly kill a Boyne raspberry. We've had them for many years. I like the Latham better. It's a bigger berry. It's juicier, but they're not quite as winter hardy. But that's a trade-off that I'll take because I'll get a crop 7 out of 10 years. We grow Nova. Nova's a Floricane variety. Wonderful berry, hardy, comes back every year. It's a good berry. And we trial 3 or 4 varieties every year because they're always coming out with new varieties. And now this year we're trying, it's an unnamed variety, it's just a number, that's a primacane. It won't grow outside, and we're growing those in that big high tunnel there. So we grow 40, 80, we grow 160 raspberries in that high tunnel in pots. And a primacane is just that. It's We get it as a bare root, we plant it in our pot, compost soil. We grow it, August we'll be picking, and we pick all the way through to freeze up. And when the plant goes dormant, we snip that cane off, and then we stack our pots up on the south side of the shop, and the next year, if it survived, we put them right back in there, it grows another cane. But they won't grow outside. We have some proven varieties that are primacane that work well for us in the high tunnel. When we do get a good crop in there, those are our fresh picked ones we sell to customers, because they're the primo crop. They haven't been rained on, and we can control that environment in there. And we like to experiment.
Do you fertilize raspberries?
Yeah, it's the same thing. You can either use 8-32-16, 3 pounds for every 100 square feet is a recommendation in the spring. But again, if you have compost, put an inch or two of compost on both sides of the bed, and you should be in pretty good shape going either way with either one of those two, depending on what your method of fertilizing is.
But
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Brian and Lori Olson for the farm tour. You can find out more about the farm at alaskaberries.com. The winery is open Wednesdays through Sundays, noon to 6 p.m. Up next, sharpen your pruning skills with arborist Curtis Stiegel. Stay tuned.